Now back to Mark Steiner.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. This is our weekly edition of Soundbites as we look at the future of the food system, farming, and our environment. And you're listening to Soundbites and the Mark Steiner show here, on WEAA-FM, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and Marva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM. And reminding you that support, this program is brought to you in part by KIDA. And good to have you all with us here today. First part of our program, we're going to be talking about something we've been covering for the last couple of years now, really, which is the Real Food Challenge, which is a move on campuses across America to bring living wages to the workers who live there, to bring food that is grown sustainably and healthy food to our campuses. And it's something that was kind of motivated by students in many ways across this country. We first learned about it in one of the places we first learned about it was a town meeting we held in Salisbury, Maryland over 2 years ago. And students came up to us saying, we're here trying to do this on our campus. We met with students from Johns Hopkins University who were doing that. One of those students is our guest on our show right now, Rachel Santo. We've had many conversations with John Berger, another guest in our program today who's coordinating this Real Food Challenge. And there was a huge breakthrough that was made at Johns Hopkins University. And we'll be talking about that and what all this means for all of us, because it doesn't just affect you at Hopkins. It affects the students. We are broadcasting here from Morgan State University. This could happen on this campus. It affects students who are at every high school across the state of Maryland and every college across the state of Maryland. So we're here with Rachel Santo, who is a senior at Johns Hopkins University, where she majors in public health studies and global environmental change and sustainability, and co-founder and co-president of Real Food Hopkins. Great to have you back again, Rachel.
Thanks.
Bill O'Connor's with us. He is director of dining programs at Johns Hopkins University. Good to meet you, Bill. Welcome
to
the studio.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you.
And John Berger's in the studio. John Berger is Mid-Atlantic Regional Coordinator for the Real Food Challenge. And, John, good to have you back again.
Nice to see you, Mark.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages or tweet us here at Mark Steiner. I've seen many tweets that this show is happening. Now you can tweet us with your thoughts, 410-319-8888. So, John, let me start with Rachel. Rachel, because you've been kind of pushing this for a long time on your campus. Talk to us about the history and your analysis of where we've come to.
Sure. So I and another student co-founded Real Food Hopkins, which is a student chapter of the National Real Food Challenge, way back in 2010 in the fall, which was my freshman year. And we set out with the lofty goal initially to get our campus to sign this, but we knew that we would have to make a lot of progress along the way, so we didn't start pushing this necessarily right away. We worked more to just build community support and become an active student group, start some traditions around local food and sustainability on campus, and work on starting a community garden, just to kind of get the community behind us and in support of the initiatives that we were doing. And then we were able to start working with administrators and faculty and staff to kind of pull everything together and to give a really good proposal to our president as to whether or not he should sign on to this commitment. So it was definitely like a very big group effort that took 3 years to evolve, but we were really excited when we had the support and mobilization of students and all the community members on campus.
I'm going to read in a moment what the things that Rachel wrote, the case for real food that she wrote on October the 17th, which there were some really interesting pieces I want to throw out there that you wrote to talk about what these really mean. So, John Berger, I mean, you've been working on campuses, a number of campuses across the region, right?
Yes.
So what's the significance here?
Hopkins is one of the largest and most prestigious schools in the state of Maryland and even in the entire Mid-Atlantic.
And it's so, not the world, some people might add.
Right. I wouldn't say that, but Bill might say that. And I think a lot of the difficulty we run into with the Real Food Challenge is that every school, every company, every vendor wants to make up their own standards for what real food means, what local means, what sustainable means. And we have our own opinions about that. We have a program called the Real Food Calculator that incorporates elements of local and sustainable and fair and humane sort of values. That it's been developed by students. It's very rigorous. It's very high standard. And that's what we think our schools should be supporting. And so having a name like Johns Hopkins sign on to that and say, like, yes, the standard made sense. We support this. We're going to go for it means a lot. And I think we'll continue to resonate out. It's already started, and I think we'll continue to resonate out towards lots of other schools.
So talk you run the dining room, and we've actually heard in one of our last panels we did with this, which was a panel we taped with the Real Food Challenge just last year.
It was in February.
February, Johns Hopkins University. We heard from the workers on the panel as well, from you who work in the dining halls. And they were really kind of very compelling and interesting. So talk to us from your perspective what this means.
I think that it gives us the opportunity to stand out. You know, Johns Hopkins is a world-renowned institution, and I think we have the opportunity to stand out and make a commitment forth. By having President Daniels sign the commitment gives us the opportunity to say that we are going to make a change and we are going to commit to a percentage of local and sustainable and humane purchasing. We have partnered recently with Bon Appetit Food Service Management Company, and I think that that is going to give us the jumping board to be able to attain the commitment by 2020.
So, okay, let me look at some of these things in what they really do say. One of the things that you showed me as you walked in the door here, John Berger, was the Real Food Campus commitment that was made by Johns Hopkins University. And the president of Johns Hopkins actually changed part of the agreement where it said by, what year was that? That by 2020, 20% of the food purchases would be part of the Real Food Calculator, would be decent food, sustainable food. But the president changed that to 35%.
that's the kind of change we can live with. Yeah.
It was an absolutely entertaining evening for all of us. Rachel and Emily and John and the folks that helped us with our 100-mile meal that evening, the evening kind of culminated with the president signing the commitment. And I think that it was a bit shocking for all of us that the president got up and redlined the contract, which is something we weren't anticipating, and the president decided to redline the 20% to a 35% commitment level, which is 15% higher than what is promised in the commitment by the year 2020. Kind of shocked us all in the room.
So, folks, if you're listening now, maybe you're on this campus, maybe you're in Towson's campus, maybe you're at Coppin State, maybe you're somewhere else around this community, maybe you're in Salisbury, wherever you are, Washington College. Join us here at 410-319-8888. What's happening on your campus? The state of food. My daughter, who's in high school, would say, I don't eat it. So her response to what happens on her campus. One of the things that you wrote in this case for real food on campus, Rachel, let me just read this one paragraph you wrote because I think it says a lot. You wrote, Johns Hopkins University students are already paying the highest premium for campus food, no less than other campuses who have more sustainable sourcing policies. That makes it imperative that we follow suit. And I love this piece. After all, we, a school full of future physicians, should recognize the need to slow the growing antimicrobial resistance problem, which has been largely attributed to the subtherapeutic use of antibiotics for growth and efficiency in farm animal production. Future ecologists should understand the dangers of ignoring massive unregulated pollution sources from industrial farming operations. Future diplomats should see how the increasing global food shortages, largely influenced by our country's agricultural policies and consumption habits, threaten international stability. And future sociologists should realize how low wages and poor working conditions for laborers throughout our food chain, one-sixth of our entire nation's workforce, perpetuate growing disparities in wealth, health, and quality of life. Yes, this may require some sacrifices on the part of individuals, but every penny we save more per pound of tomatoes to ensure we aren't supporting modern-day slavery conditions like in Immokalee, Florida, or a dollar more for coffee and tea, and you go on. But I'll stop there for a moment. So, Rachel, talk about kind of politically, socially, what you're describing here and what kind of motivated this and what you're saying about the changes we have to make.
Sure. Well, I think something that's so compelling about working to change the food system is that it is so interdisciplinary. It covers almost every aspect of our lives in a different way. And when I first got into food work, I came in from a nutrition angle and was really interested in just the science behind nutrition. But then I started learning more and more about climate change and realized how deeply connected our food system was to that, and then started learning more about social justice and how food is related to that. And pretty soon I realized that literally every person I talk to has a connection, not just by eating food, but also in whatever they're working on. There's usually some connection to food. And I think that's what we realized as a student group was we could capitalize on that. We could find that little spark or connection that everyone has to food and help them realize why we need to change the food system. And as a result, if we work to change these aspects of our food system, perhaps we can make all the other aspects better too, whether it's, you know, reducing our greenhouse gas emissions or improving workforce conditions, things like that. It really resonated with me that this was a pivotal connection point that we could help motivate change around.
I'm very curious, Bill O'Connor. I was calling you O'Connor, but it's Bill Connor, not Bill O'Connor. Bill Connor, excuse me for butchering your name. What does this mean for the university in terms, because, you know, I know that most universities will contract with a fairly large conglomerate to buy food in bulk that is warehoused and brought in, and that's the food that gets served at night, usually cooked fresh on campus. It changes the nature of pricing, changes the nature of how you buy food. So I'm curious how that affects what that will change for you and for the dining halls.
You know, I think we just have the opportunity to sign the commitment and be able to jump forth from there. And John and I were talking prior to coming on the show about getting our food systems working group up and started so that we can identify where we are, where our current benchmark is. And we have students in our office that are currently evaluating the Bon Appetit purchasing for the month of September.
That's so your new contractor, right?
Yep, the new contractor.
One of the things I read about that was that that made you all more optimistic about the possibilities of change.
Absolutely. You know, one of the nice things about Bon Appetit is their Farm to Fork program, really being able to come into the city, find vendors that are local, sustainable, humane, have fair wage laws and those sort of things, and be able to put those sort of vendors in our dining halls. Of those 25, you know, we're proud to champion a couple that are here within the city limits. Big City Farms is producing a lot of our greens.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting a large percentage from them. We're using One Straw Farm, which is not too far out of the city, and then like Rosetta Beef is
Southern
supplying.
Southern Pennsylvania, right.
Yeah, so Rosetta Beef is also supplying a good portion of the meats that we're supplying here on campus. So
I think Baltimore County.
Yeah, so I think it gives us the opportunity for Bon Appetit to develop those local farm relationships, to be able to meet this commitment, and to be able to meet the challenge that we've put forth for ourselves.
So, and John, so in your organizing work, I mean, this has got to be, in some ways, one of the most important things that have happened. I mean, how does this fare in comparison with the other work that you're doing on other campuses?
So when I first started organizing with the Ruffo Challenge about 2.5 years ago, one of the first things that I did was to go have coffee with Rachel. She was, I think, one of the only students that was involved with the Ruffo Challenge in the Mid-Atlantic at that time. And so that was, she was like, uh-huh. Okay, I'll start with the people that we have. And so that was Rachel. And Rachel was talking a little bit before about sort of the journey that we've been on it of learning and changing through this process. And I think it's been really inspirational for me to work with these Hopkins students over an extended period and really see this thing through. And that said, it's also true that sort of, let's see, Hopkins is way far out ahead of most other schools on this.
And why do you think that is?
It's a good question. I think having the students involved, in the process to switch contractors was a big piece. I mean, a year ago, Hopkins
I remember
was,
when this started, you yeah. were actually reticent to be optimistic about the ability to do that.
Yeah. So a year ago, Hopkins was contracting with Aramark,
right.
Which is whatever one of the big three companies
right.
that control 92% of the higher education food service market. Aramark is also the one that is least willing to work with students, least willing to buy locally, to be flexible about insurance requirements, to do the things that make it possible for local and small-scale farmers to sell to an institution of this size. And so they were unwilling to let the students use the Real Food Calculator to find out where exactly their food was coming from. That's been a challenge we've seen at Aramark at a lot of schools. And Bon Appetit is better on those things. I wouldn't say that they're perfect. I don't know exactly what's going on at the dining halls myself at Hopkins or anywhere, but they are much more flexible. They're much more willing to work with smaller producers and students.
And before we turn back to Well, let's do that. Then I'll go to Rachel because it's very specific. I want to ask Rachel. So pick up on what Bill, what John just said in terms of both limitations and what's actually changing and how that will change.
Sure. Well, I mean, just in what I've observed on campus, in the switch from Aramark to Bon Appetit, I've made sure to purchase a meal plan every year, even though I'm a senior now and don't have to. I think it's really integral to working on these issues to understand like how the food is changing and is it improving, what are things that people still don't necessarily like or want to see changed. And I've noticed tremendous changes in the quality of food offered by Bon Appetit, whether it's at the small little sandwich shop where now like all the greens are local and organic and really fresh, or the meat is now all mostly grass-fed beef or pasture-raised chicken. People have definitely noticed that and pointed things out, and there's always room for improvement. As a vegetarian, I've helped lead the Vegetarian Vegan Committee, and we've had a lot of discussions about things that we would like to see continue to improve, but Bon Appetit has been really willing to sit down and talk with us through those and offer suggestions and be willing to work in support with us. So I think that like there's always room for improvement, but I definitely have seen a significant change in the quality of food since just over the past year, and I think other students are recognizing that too.
And talk a bit about, from your perspective, managing this. I mean, how has that changed? I mean, literally, what the question was that John was talking about, you don't know what's actually happening in the dining halls, how those changes manifest themselves. How do they?
I think the first step...
I was talking to Bill Connor.
Okay.
I think the opportunity, first and foremost, is for us to have a great working partnership with Bon Appetit. Johns Hopkins University Dining, prior to selecting Bon Appetit, had a vision of what they wanted, and part of that vision was local sustainable food so that we were being conscious purchasers in the food environment. And I think that working with Bon Appetit has definitely been a benefit with them coming into our campus and being able to bring in suppliers from other campuses that they're currently at was a nice way to segue into that. But I think with the volume and the commitment that we're able to purchase from local folks at the quantity that we need at Johns Hopkins University, it really puts us in the forefront of being able to be a large supplier, or actually a large purchaser of the local food in the local environment here in Baltimore.
You want to say what, John?
Yeah. Bill earlier brought up this concept of food systems working group, that's sort of the step that we're at Hopkins, is building that working group. And I want to sort of explain some of the history behind that, which is that one of the things that we were really looking at as we were designing the Roughwood Campus Commitment was a prior campaign that was called the President's Climate Commitment. And this was a thing that was active around 2005, 2007, that era, had about 450, 500 college campuses sign this pledge to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by really lofty goals in a lot of cases. And mostly what has happened at those schools for the most part is that either the school has done nothing to follow through, or they created an office, hired one of the students that got them to sign the thing and hired them and stuck them in a corner somewhere and told them to do it. Or they have made a plan and not really followed through, or just haven't been able to commit the resources to actually make it happen. And so we really tried to learn from that experience when we were designing how this Real Food Commitment was going to be implemented. It's not just going to be the president signs a document and then it sits in a corner somewhere and like we'll see if it happens. It's a more engaged, multi-stakeholder process where we're not just sort of relying on Bon Appetit, but also bringing in the expertise and the knowledge of students and staff and faculty and folks that aren't even part of Hopkins that live in the area, maybe local farmers, the dining workers that are going to cook the food, bringing in all of those voices and all of that different expertise to really make this thing work for everyone.
So two quick questions. I'm curious in the 5 or 6 minutes we have left here in this particular segment. First to Rachel, then I'm going to go back to each one of you and then to John about other campuses. Rachel, talk about how you organized this among the students. What was the response? What did you do?
Sure. Well, first we just started gathering support within our group. So we networked and kind of pulled together all the students that we had heard about or knew were interested in food issues and kind of formed Real Food Hopkins. But then to get the broader campus support, we knew that we had to kind of pick students' interests, so we did what we called surveys, because Hopkins isn't a big activist-y school, and so signing a petition kind of freaks some people out. And so we conducted more of surveys asking students would they be more interested in local sustainable food, If so, what are they looking for? What qualities matter most to them? And we conducted that and got over 500 students to kind of sign their support at the end of the survey that they wanted more local and sustainable food. And we brought that to dining along with getting some students on the committee to help choose who would be our next food service contractor, which turned out to be Bon Appetit. So we kind of got on the in that way, in the sense that we were having our voice heard on that committee, but also just collecting student opinions and through the surveys that we did.
And I'm curious, how realistic is this for other campuses? We're sitting here at Morgan State University. We are being heard right now at Salisbury University. Other students from other campuses are listening to this. How realistic is this for campuses to make this kind of change? Those campuses, other campuses. Yeah, John.
Every school can do this. Absolutely. That's why we, you know, it's that 20% real food by tomorrow or by next year. There's many growing seasons in between now and 2020, which is when we say we want to have shifted 20% of the entire college food market towards real food. And sort of the idea behind the commitment is that sort of if you start to approach this problem from like the very like details, like, okay, how are we going to switch our lettuce to being organic lettuce? It's sort of like the tendency is to quickly become overwhelmed by all the details and all the sort of the money stuff and the logistics things. We think that it will work better, and this is sort of what we're trying out at Hopkins, to get a lot of folks together around a table, set some really ambitious but definitely realistic goals, like what do we actually want to do, and then use all of that energy and all that collaboration to make it happen.
So finally, I guess, what can we say? I'm sorry, John.
I think that having a school like Hopkins sign on and even at sign on at such a high percentage is really going to facilitate this being much easier at lots of other schools in the region. Like the reality is that the infrastructure to bring local and sustainable food to institutions like this, we don't have enough of it. A lot of our food system is dominated by the huge players, massive Sysco warehouses. And so what having Hopkins sign on does is it creates more of a guarantee that that infrastructure will be used. It makes it easier for other schools to do this.
And I think what there's also is testimony to is that whether we're talking about universities, public or private, whether we're talking about private schools or public schools whose food budget is around $1 billion across the state of Maryland, that kind of purchasing power can help change the nature of the food system and what people eat. That's the big this dollar power is huge.
Absolutely, I agree. I think that Johns Hopkins being the first institution in the state of Maryland and then obviously a great institution of our size and caliber, I really think that getting some of our colleagues in the area more regionally being able to buy into the commitment and to be able to support that is going to facilitate the region being able to better develop that system that we're looking for to provide local and sustainable and humane food to college students.
This has been fascinating. I mean, first, congratulations to Johns Hopkins and to the Real Food Challenge for getting this to happen. This is the beginning, and let's hope this is something that can be pushed. One of the things we said at the end here, which would be interesting to explore, is if the consortiums of the universities even have more buying power if they actually work together, if that's even a possibility, and what that would mean. First, Rachel Santo was co-founder and co-president of Real Food Hopkins, now a senior at Hopkins, who spearheaded this on her campus. Thanks for being the activist you are, Rachel, and appreciate you being on the show once again.
Thank you, Mark.
And Bill Connor, who is director of dining programs at Johns Hopkins University. Good to have you with us. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Mark. And thanks to Rachel and your team and to John for help bringing this to our attention and helping us get to where we are today. So thank you all.
And our partner here on Soundbites, John Berger, Mid-Atlantic Regional Coordinator for the Real Food Challenge. Good to see you, John. Thank you so much.
Great to see you, too.
We're going to take a brief break. And when we come back from this break here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show, we're going to be talking with Jenny Hopkinson, who covers agricultural and food policy issues for political program, writes the Morning Ag blog for Politico. That's it. Politico is the name of part. Sorry. And we'll be talking about things that are going on all over the country that you may not have heard of in news about food and farming and GMOs and more. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back here to the Mark Steiner Show. And Soundbites are a weekly look at the food system, farming, and the environment. You're listening to this program on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. And we're about to talk to Jenny Hopkinson. Jenny Hopkinson covers agricultural and food policy issues for Politico and writes the Morning Agricultural blog. I'm glad we discovered this. And Jenny, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here.
And the number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. We got a little piece in here from Darius saying he really appreciates this kind of programming. I appreciate you listening. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. So, Jenny, this is really an interesting piece that you do every week. So just for all this, because I haven't heard you yet or read the piece of Politico.com, which you can read on the web, this is kind of your weekly overview of what is big news in agriculture, food, and farming that we might not see.
That's well, it's actually, Mark, it's daily. We put out
daily. Well, excuse me.
Sorry, credit, someone does it every day. But yeah, so every morning, Morning Ag, which is our kind of morning tip sheet on food and ag policy, comes out. And yeah, it's forward-looking. It tries to capture what's coming up that day and what's big. You know, we have a great team that just launched at Politico doing ag and food policy, and this is kind of one of the products that we do. So yeah, it's a very interesting thing to have to put together every day.
Well, let's start with what you're covering in Washington State in this today, because today is Election Day. And we covered pretty intensely the GMO battles in California and some other places on the ballot measures. Things are heating up in Washington and maybe in Oregon next year because of this. But talk about what's going on in Washington.
Well, yeah, Washington State has a ballot initiative that would on the ballot today that would require the labeling of foods that contain genetically modified ingredients. There are some exemptions for things like alcohol and feed for animals, things like that. But yeah, and so Washington voters who vote entirely absentee have to have their ballots postmarked by the end of day today. Tonight we're going to start seeing returns come in. According to the Secretary of State's office up there, about 60% of votes will probably be ready to be counted tonight, and then the rest of the 40% will trickle in throughout the week. But it's been a really interesting race. You know, in September, 66% of Washington voters, according to a poll out there, supported GMO labeling. By October 21st, that was down to 46% supporting, 42% opposing, and then kind of 12% undecided. So this is going to be a really close race, a really tight race. You know, we saw similar things last year in California where the Prop 37 GMO balloting, or excuse me, their GMO ballot initiative lost by just 3%. Or 3 percentage points. So it's going to be close. It's going to be a late night for us on the East Coast watching this race. But it's really interesting. You know, the food industry has pumped a lot of money into this race. It's the no side has raised $22 million, a lot of that coming from food and biotech companies. Well, in fact, the vast majority of it coming from food and biotech companies. And, you know, kind of in a similar trend to what they did in California. But, yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how the vote falls.
This is it's raised a bunch of issues here, I think. And I'm curious how you see it as a reporter for Politico in this incredible series you're doing. And I'm glad you're doing this series and glad you're joining us today. But on the one hand, this speaks to the tremendous power of, in this case, agricultural corporate money in a race and how that can affect people's opinions no matter where they start. On the other, it also reflects people's real concern about GMOs and also their confusion about GMOs.
Yeah, and well, I think you certainly hit on something there, this kind of concept of confusion on GMOs. You know, in polling and in studies that have been done, it's been found that, you know, if you ask people if they want their food that contains GMO labeling, or excuse me, if you ask people whether or not they want food that contains GMOs to be labeled, they say yes. But
by overwhelming percentages. But if you ask, you know, what are the biggest concerns that you have about, you know, about what's in your food and what would you like to see labeled, they don't often come forward with, oh, I want GMOs. I mean, it's kind of this interesting dichotomy on that front where if you ask the question straight, people will say yes, but they don't really know why. And industry, industry has admitted this to me recently, that, you know, when you look at Monsanto's and Dow's and the biotech industry as a whole, for so long they've been focused on reaching their customers versus the average, you know, consumer like you or I who are eating, you know, GMO corn and GMO soy every day because it's in almost everything. You know, they haven't done that consumer outreach to explain the science, to explain, you know, its benefits, to explain what it does. And so it's kind of this interesting consumer awareness thing. And if you ask the No campaign in Washington State, you know, they've had many newspapers in the state, the editorial boards of these newspapers, come out against the ballot initiative. And kind of in speaking to the No campaign, they've told me that, you know, when these newspapers, you know, and the editorial boards ask the questions and ask about the science and ask about the ballot initiative, you know, they find that it's kind of not what it's made out to be by the yes side, that there are a lot of questions around it. They say it's poorly written. And so, yeah, this kind of consumer confusion is definitely at issue. You know, and so that's, I think, you know, one of the reasons we may see, we've seen the kind of support wane for the initiative in Washington State. You know, as far as agricultural money in the race, yes, Monsanto, Dow, kind of the other biotech companies have contributed a lot of money. The food industry has contributed about half of what the no side has raised, and I might be slightly off of those numbers, but the Grocery Manufacturers Association has put in, I think, $11 million of the $22 million at this juncture, and you know, and that's coming from companies like Coca-Cola and Pepsi, General Mills, Nestle, and so the food companies are very, very concerned about this. They don't want labeling, and so that's where a lot of the money is coming from as well.
And that's, I guess, what I was alluding to earlier. I mean, I think the races we've covered around the country around this and other issues like this, I mean, I think that that's part of the big concern many Americans begin to have about how kind of fueling campaigns with this kind of wealth, whether it's from Monsanto and Coca-Cola or anywhere else, can really shift opinion because they have the power to put three times as many ads on television, put mailers out, and to strong arm is the wrong word, but to influence editorial boards and elected officials.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and that's definitely a concern. And, you know, and we've seen, you know, this is kind of the same strategy that the food and ag, the food and biotech industries used in California last year. They just pumped money into it, and you can bet that if other states start to look at this, kind of come the new year when legislatures go back into session, you know, we're probably going to see the same process again, just the pumping money. But it is a lot of money. I mean, you know, yes, these are big companies, but to fight this hard every year is, and who knows? But it's just a lot of money.
So you also come in covering some other things that I found interesting. The it's not humorous, only humorous because of the characters. When you wrote about Elmo and Big Bird, pushing our healthier food for our children.
Yes. So we have a fantastic kind of FDA reporter and kind of. And I'm drawing a blank, but Helena Bottomiller-Evich has covered the First Lady's Let's Move campaign. You know, and this agreement that she's brokered between Sesame Street and the produce industry is a big deal. I mean, this is a kind of marketing campaign that's worth, you know, probably hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, that really could have the potential to change the produce industry and its ability to sell things. You know, it's, you know, the produce industry doesn't have huge profit margins, you know, whereas here's this free advertising campaign, you know, with, you know, Sesame Street, which is a huge brand among children. And, you know, Helena talks about this concept of tester power and kids, you know, see an Elmo stick around an apple and want that and pester their parents about it. But it's also a brand Sesame Street is also a brand that parents like and that parents trust, you know, not to kind of mislead them. So it's a huge opportunity for the produce industry. And it'll be really interesting to see how they start to move it. We probably won't start seeing kind of the effects of it until 2014, but it will be interesting what produce aisles start looking like next year.
It's interesting. This is that people. This really hasn't been covered a great deal. I haven't seen a lot of this, except when I read your piece, and how huge a role the First Lady Michelle Obama played in brokering this deal.
Yeah, she's really. I mean, every pun intended. She's really trying to use the carrot over the stick with a lot of these. You gotta love it. With a lot of these kind of efforts to move forward on the Let's Move campaign. I mean, she's, you know, worked with Sesame Street. She's worked with kind of water companies, and she's done a couple events with, I think, some of the big athletic wear companies, you know, and to try and kind of encourage them to participate in these efforts to reduce childhood obesity. She's played a huge role in this. It's certainly something that could have a great effect. You know, at the same time, I think some very outspoken food safety or kind of food safety and health advocates aren't very much of a fan of this tactic because they would like to see something firm and sound policy from the Obama administration. But at the same time, it is a way that the White House is able to kind of get results and to get kind of signs of something working out. And I think. In a couple of years, and the Sesame Street marketing deal with the produce industry is, I think, 2 years long. And I think it'll be really interesting to see the data after those 2 years to say, you know, how much an increase in carrots and things like that has been, and to kind of gauge how effective the First Lady's tactics have been.
And finally, Jenny, just a brief comment on what you see happening with the food bill that you wrote about the other day.
The farm bill?
Yes. Did I say food? I meant farm bill. Yeah, right.
So the farm bill conference committee the primaries on the farm bill conference committee are hard at work. I know we're broadcasting on Delmarva, and I actually spent 2 years at the Daily Times in Salisbury, so uh-huh. I speak a bit of fluent poultry, if you will. I think there are a lot of very relevant issues at stake in the farm bill, and I think one of the ones that we might it will be interesting to watch how it works out. There's language in the House version that would kind of take away, and I could be phrasing this badly, but would take away protections that were in the 2008 farm bill for kind of poultry growers and livestock growers, kind of protections from processors, kind of from the Purdue's and Tyson's and kind of that ilk, or not that ilk, but yeah, from processors to kind of, so the 2008 Farm Bill had protections for the growers from the processors kind of to prevent processors from requiring upgrades to poultry houses when, you know, they were considering canceling contracts, kind of other business practices. There is talk of getting rid of, there's in the House version now, there is a provision that would get rid of those protections, or at least kind of dial them back. A lot of groups have come out against that. A lot of, you know, the National Farmers Union, the Alabama Poultry Growers Association, kind of a lot of groups have come out against it, especially on the grower level. But you know that there is movement from especially Republican lawmakers who say that it's interfering with. You know, it's just another layer of regulation. Of course, poultry processors and meat processors across the board don't like those provisions. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. The Daily Times has covered it, and they actually got a quote from or a response from Rep. Andy Harris from the 1st District saying that, you know, he supports the House language, he supports getting rid of these provisions, which, you know, may or may not bode well for Delmarva Poultry, but at the same time, Representative Harris isn't on the conference committee, and so it'll be interesting to see how that issue is played out and kind of what attention it gets. I mean, the Farm Bill Conference Committee really does have until Thanksgiving, and kind of Colin Peterson, who's ranking member of the conference committee on the House side has said they're going to try and get the majority of it done before Thanksgiving, because this thing really has to pass before the end of the year. So it could be that this is one of those issues that, you know, while it looks like it could be a big fight, may not rise to a level that at least the principals on the Farm Bill are willing to hash it out over. It'll be interesting to follow.
It will be interesting. We look forward to having you help us do that. And we're talking to Jenny Hopkinson, who writes the Morning Agriculture, a daily briefing on agriculture and food policy for Politico. Jenny, thanks so much. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for letting me be here.
Appreciate you coming. Look forward to having you back with us again.
Yeah, I look forward to the same.
Thank you. We're going to switch gears and bring on one of our favorite folks here, Michael Twitty. Michael Twitty is culinary historian of African and African-American foodways and a blogger at Afroculinaria. He recently appeared in the PBS miniseries, The African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross, with Henry Louis Gates, Jr. And Master Michael Twitty, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Well, good morning. How y'all doing?
Very well. How are you doing?
I am traveled out. I just came back from Madison, Wisconsin, by way of Portland, Oregon, by way of New York, by way of Austin, by way of Philadelphia, by way of Austin, Texas. So I am by way of North Carolina. So I have been on the road for a minute.
So, well, take a breath.
One breath.
Good to have you here. And congratulations on being part of the PBS miniseries. That was great to see that you were part of that.
Well, thank you. It was a fantastic experience.
So talk a bit about what you – so let's start with this. I'm curious, as we approach these holiday season, you always have some interesting things to think about when it comes to recipes. Before we get into something else, give us one right now.
All right. So this is what I've been thinking about. I've really been trying to think about how do we recontextualize all this stuff we see in terms of something that, you know, I like to use food as a means of teaching history.
Yes.
So I thought about, like, some foods that particularly reflect this area, you know, this sort of, like, Chesapeake area, you know, that has all of these influences from around the world. But, in particular, in my heritage, we're talking about African-American and West Indian roots of the Chesapeake. So I thought about that, and I said, man, wouldn't it be cool if we took, like, and this is going to be a rough chop recipe, so people got to follow along the best way they can. This is a grandmama recipe.
All right, go ahead.
You ready for that?
Yep.
All right, cool. Grab your pencils now.
Let's go, do it.
Unless you're driving.
And we'll try to write this quickly so we can get it on the web. Go ahead, go.
Awesome. Heyman sweet potatoes. You know Heyman sweet potatoes.
Uh-huh.
The rare ones, you know, the white ones. Or you can get white yam, or you can get O. Henry's. And you cube those up, small cubes. You get your orange or Beauregard or Georgia Jet sweet potatoes. You cube those up. You also get some Kushaw squash, the big striped squash. Or you can even use, like, a butternut squash. And you cube that up in little cubes, maybe like an inch or two cubes. And it's rough chop rosemary. Put some coarse black pepper on there, some sea salt, some kosher salt. You take, this is the fun part, you take chicken fat or duck fat, if you got it.
I love duck fat.
Or you can use olive oil, and you just roll them in that. Just let them roll in that melted fat and the salt, the black pepper, the herbs, whatever. Just take all those cubes. Let's say that you have about a cup or two. Let's say 2 cups each. You put that in the bottom of a greased or oiled roasting pan, something that's not going to stick. Or something that you can remove easily. It'll crust up a little bit, but you can take them out at the end. And then you put about a cup and a half of chicken broth over that. On top of that, you're going to lay down 2 small 3-pound chickens. No more than 4 pounds, but it's a nice big roasting pan, 3 or 4 pound chickens. Chickens that you have brined in salt and sugar equal parts in a gallon of water. You let them sit in there for a couple hours. You take them out, you rinse them, you put margarine, olive oil, butter, whatever you want, on under the skin, around the chicken, and you stuff the underskin with herbs. And then you take that, and you salt and pepper them, like I said before, you put them on top. You start them off at 500 degrees, you get a nice sear on the chicken, and then you turn that sucker down.
How long do you put at 500?
Oh, for half an hour.
Okay.
and then you take it. Then you take it down to about 350, and you let them sit at 350 for about, I'd say, an hour and a half, covered with foil. So everything gets done. Everything's tender. Everything's juicy. Everything's moist. Then you rip that foil off. You test the chicken to make sure it's done. If not, you can put it in for another half an hour, but I don't think you will. And if the squash and the sweet potatoes are soft and the chickens above are done to the bone, you're good to go. Oh, special note.
Yeah.
Make sure you put a little bit of ginger, a little bit of allspice, and a little bit of cayenne pepper. You can either pound it in a mortar and pestle, or you can just take pinches of the dried stuff. And make sure you liberally season in light batches all over the chicken and the sweet potatoes before you send them to the table.
Chicken and sweet potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
So now when you... go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's an old-fashioned... See, that is actually as West African as you get, right? Because you got your yams, you got your chicken.
You got it all. So when you start off with your vegetables, you cook them first? Did you say you cooked them first?
You cook them in the pan with the chicken.
No, okay, gotcha.
All the chicken juices will go down onto the sweet potatoes and the squash.
Have you made this before?
Oh, tons of times. It's the easiest thing to make.
That doesn't sound too hard.
You want to hear the trefa version?
Yeah.
The trefa. You might do the trefa version. I'm scared. You might do the trefa version. You actually take big slices of country ham.
Well, let me stop for a moment because you're talking to Michael Twitty here, and when he says trefa version, he means the non-kosher version. So go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, you put like big slices of like real deal, not no mashes. I'm talking about some real deal country ham at the bottom of the pan. So your stuff is being flavored on both ends, and you can do that with other non-pork stuff. You can do that with smoked turkey slices. You can do that with duck prosciutto. You can do that with lamb, bacon. You can do that with whatever you want. So, but I guarantee you, it will flavor it up on both ends.
And we're talking to a man who can cook with ham but doesn't eat it.
There you go.
So in the few minutes we have left, Michael, so tell me, why have you been traveling around the country? What have you been doing?
So basically, newsflash to all our local universities and schools, I've been invited to talk about culinary justice, something we might talk about soon. It's becoming a bigger theme now that I'm writing more about that and talking more about it. The idea that we have to give not only credit where credit is due, but we have to allow oppressed communities to use food as a means of transforming their existence, you know, economically, financially, additionally, mentally, spiritually, psychologically, and not just have everything be co-opted and taken away and appropriated. So school after school, food studies program after food studies program, and African-American studies and African studies, whatever they are, have been inviting, Jewish studies have been inviting me to different universities to come be a scholar in residence. So that's what I've been doing. That's what I'm going to keep doing into 2014. But I would love to do that right here at home because it seems a good fit. It seems a good place to do it. But hey, I'm going to Oregon. I'm going to San Francisco in December. So I don't know. I don't know, man. Everybody else seems to need more culinary justice in the Baltimore, D.C. area.
Well, here's what we'll do. We'll work on a segment with you to get on this program on culinary justice and explore what that means in depth.
How about it?
Michael Twitty has been here. Great recipe. I need to try this recipe. He'll be on the show as much as we can get him on in the midst of his travels for comments on culinary justice and food and the future of agriculture and more, as well as his incredible recipes. Michael Twitty is culinary historian of African-American foodways and a blogger at Afro Culinaria, which we will link to. And recently appeared in the PBS miniseries The African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross with Henry Louis Gates Jr. And my friend Michael Twitty, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Take care. Sounds like I'm going to try this recipe. Reminding you here, The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Ennery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, find out information about our guests and the work they do and what we've been talking about here, and the recipes, please go to steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner for The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. Take care.